So, the Mold Mate Club I used to see and used to think it was an intriguing-looking place, but I never got to go in it. And I thought it'd be nice to go in there one day.
I always remember it being very red-looking, the place. It's building on the corner of the green. It was dark most of the time, and people used to say, I wonder what goes on in there, and nobody quite knew how you could get in to join it or anything.
But in Newington Green itself was... it was a tip. I remember when everything felt much more of an earlier period somehow. And then the Mild Maze retained that because I always hoped that little turret at the top, I don't know what you call it, there's a little glass bit, which I think the windows are filled in now because the cost of replacing them is too much. But I think that was used to see right across. I think you see right down to the Thames, someone said. But I have no idea if that's true because I haven't been up there to look, so I don't know. But the Mild Maid had a particular feel to it, which felt like centuries old. And I became a member. I walked in and became a member.
My wife's friend worked as a barmaid upstairs, and that was 1969. And she kept asking us to come over and have a night out, and we talked about it, and then we decided to come over, and she signed us in because I wasn't a member at that time, so she signed us in. And but when we got here, the whole footpath with people queuing up, ladies sequin dresses and the men all dressed lovely, and I said, I don't think we're going to get in. Look at the crowd, you know. So our friend came down to the door and she called us in. She signed us in and everything. So I thought, oh, what a lovely night we had. It. And all the beautiful women dancing, the dresses, it was just fantastic. I couldn't believe it, you know, because being coming from where I come from, you only seen dresses like that once in a blue moon, ladies dressing up like that once in a blue moon, and it just took my breath away, really.
I couldn't believe the size of the place. I couldn't believe, you know, that everything was decorated and all different things, the bars, and the big hall upstairs, that's fucking... It gobsmacked me. I just couldn't believe this, you know. It was beautiful. Absolutely gorgeous.
It was something to look forward to come out on a Saturday night, you know. It was always... Then the big hall, the metro hall, that was like a full band for dancing, singing, and packed. All the seats were taken and everybody got up and danced. And it was proper entertainment. A live band, yes, probably 8-piece, you know, full band. Ladies singing, sometimes men, and then everybody would, they'd be playing 60s music, country and western, and some jazz, not a lot, but some jazz, yes.
If you went over and asked a lady to dance upstairs, she would dance with you, but she was with a partner, she'd turn around and say, is that okay? And it would, oh yeah, go have a dance. But like me and the wife would be up there, and Danny Murphy would come over and he'd say to my missus, are you dancing or what? and then he used to look at me, is it all right? I'd say, yeah, go on, take it away. If the lady hadn't got a guy to dance with, they'd put their bags in the middle of the floor and dance around the bags themselves, you know. Oh, God.
We would just come up on a Saturday night and you'd have bands always playing live in the main hall. And I remember getting here early once and, you know, the soap, flakes of soap they put on the floor, they was doing that and I couldn't work out why, and Dad was explaining it so that when they dance they can slide across the floor. I only ever saw that happen once, though. But, yeah, that's always stuck in my head. Because most people did used to dance, like, sort of doing the waltz and that. But the bands was... Because it was in the 70s, sort of early 80s, they'd be doing cover songs. There was always a cover song. It was never their own music. And I remember they used to do Knock Three Times on the Ceiling If You Want Me, Twice on the Pipes If the Answer Is No. They all sang that. They all seemed to play that song. That's the one song that sticks in my head. So, yeah.
You look at them nowadays.
Couldn't wear jeans Saturday night.
No, you had to dress.
Couldn't have to dress.
Yeah.
Suit
jeans
and
on shoulders. Jeans on shoulders. Yeah.
You had to dress Saturday night.
Yeah, no, you dress your best and dance the night away. I'd often be in glitter, that was my thing.
But all the older folk from the area, you know, especially the ladies, and they all got, you know, I mean, I come in a pair of jeans maybe on it, but they'd come with their and fancy dress, you know, dressed up, and it was nice. You know, all the earrings and the jewels.
And the ladies would like earlier, you know, the old members, they would well, Bacardi, about four of them, Jack Bacardi. I mean, I'd get through that whole bottle of Bacardi a night, because which obviously to me now is quite an old fashioned drink, you know, and but it's quite popular then, you know, Bacardi and Diet Coke. There's one old woman, Betty. Oh, she was lovely, Betty. I mean, she was, I remember it was her 90th. I mean, she was still coming in up till 91, and vodka and bitter lemon was her drink. And when she stopped coming in due to ill health, we stopped doing bitter lemon, because she was the only one, but she would be good for about 8 or 9 vodka and bitter lemons every Saturday.
We used to sit mostly in the small hall up the top, and everybody had their seats.
Special seats.
So if you sat in someone else's seat, you sort of got looked at. Or yeah, if somebody new came in, who's that sitting in our seat?
But that was stopped. That was stopped towards the end, wasn't it? Because they couldn't do that. But I still probably did. Probably left one of the kids there. Oh, no, you can't sit. That's my uncles. That's my aunts. That's my sisters.
I just like being able to get out and bring the kids. You couldn't go out otherwise.
I didn't have many friends. It was
no, it was just nice, because
you should come out for a drink with your husband and friends and all that.
All our friends had children at the same time. Mm. Everybody knew them because they'd been coming up since they were babies, and it was just social life.
It would just be full of children Saturday night.
My dad was a member, and must have been about 7, 8 when we used to come up here. We used to sit in that side bit of the main hall, and my sister used to drink pineapple, so I've got a memory of my dad putting his thumb over the top of the bottle and shaking it, so she's got all the bits there. And then I thought I was very grown up, because Dad would put a splash of beer in me lemonade, and I had a shandy. I thought I was ever so grown up.
I spoke to my sister to see, and she said she remembers it seeming really big, like just massive. And we used to sit in the bar. Is it the tartan bar? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, yeah.
We'd always sit there, and we'd have our crisps and our Coke or whatever. And then once the parents had a few drinks, they'd loosen up a bit and be a bit more relaxed, and we could leave them and go and find somewhere. And it was like an Aladdin's cave, really, because you wouldn't know what you'd discover. But there was always that we needed to behave because we were lucky to be here. There was that sort of feeling, and we didn't want to spoil it by misbehaving, running around. That was forbidden. And I remember going upstairs, and there was a live band on, and it was on the stage, and never seen nothing like it before. It was like Las Vegas or somewhere. And it was like glam rock. They were playing Fire, like really loud, pumping out, and people were dancing, and it was amazing. It was such a great feeling. And we would sit up there, just the four of us, and have our own little get together, yeah, with our drink and crisps. And
because it was dark up there as well, you feel like you was hidden and nobody could see, yeah, you, weren't it? You could spy on everyone else.
We were
else.
Spying, yeah. We were literally looking down on them, and they were all partying away on the dance floor.
Like the wood panels, the glitter curtains, the sausage roll stained carpet. That's my childhood right there. The no smoking on the dance floor sign, the no children running on the dance floor sign, which I just ignored at the time. that's what brings back memories. Yeah. And growing up, like, the smell of cigarette smoke, I don't know if that's still ingrained in the velour sofas upstairs. You've definitely got the little cigarette holes in some of the seats. And you've also got little holes in the seats where women used to stand in their stilettos. But yeah, growing up, I remember the smell of smoke. I'd go home and I'd smell of smoke on my clothes. But yeah, and I also remember children used to like to, not necessarily me, but there were some naughty children who used to pick up things from the buffet, mostly prawns and cockles, and throw them at each other and have a food fight. So I can distinctly remember the smell of fish in the tartan bar, yeah. But mostly stale beer, that was the main scent.
Nice. I used to have hindus up here. My first ever hindu I came to up here, hindu. Which was an experience.
This lady, Lil, I hope it's not boring, by the way, but she'd never been to one before. And she said, well, can I come? I said, I don't really think it's your cup of tea, Lil. So she said to me, why not? So I said to her, you know, they take all their clothes off, you know. Doesn't do that, she said. Like Ranky Stender. So I said, yeah. What? She said, can I come? I said, if you want to. So anyway, I had a word with the stripper and he came. And I said, look, there's going to be an elderly lady sitting next to me. She's my friend. She said, don't make a beeline for her, will you? Don't, you know, leave her alone, won't you? Okay, so point her out, so I did. Anyway, Lil made her, when they were all dancing, then he gets out the baby cream, the baby oil, and he's going up and down the aisle, and she's grabbed his hand. She's grabbed his hand, so because he must have thought, well, you know, he got the wrong one. So he's led her back to the front of all the people, and she's proceeded to rub, you know, cream on him, on his bum. And so I thought, oh God, I'm sitting there, I was really in a bad way. I thought, God, Bill will kill me. You know, anyway, so I said, don't forget, what goes on up here stays up here. I said, don't tell Bill. Okay, Bren, she said. I said, don't, nobody's going to say anything. I said, you had a good night in Devon. She said, oh yeah. So anyway, what happened? All the husbands are sitting downstairs. She comes trotting down and she went, oh, Bill, she said. She said, I was with the stripper, she said, and he asked me to rub cream all over his bum. And I saw the husbands are all looking, you know, just keep it secret. But it was so funny.
Yes, it was male strippers wanting. Yeah. And the place we packed with women, young and old. But the old people actually enjoyed it, I think. Maybe brought back some of their memories. And then the stag do's. You know, the hen do's was, yeah, they had male strippers in, but the women came in to have a drink and a laugh as well. Where the men, it was a completely different thing. It was, you know, to put men on the ground and did things to them. I don't want to say the word. Well, they had their trousers down, let's put it that way.
On a Sunday morning, up in the top bar, it's not the big old one above it, and you used to have Fred and Rose on the piano, and everyone used to get up and sing. It was just family party.
I used to love Sunday mornings because it was a real, just a good time. Everybody, as I say, the singers used to get up and you'd be here till about 3 o'clock, then go home and have dinner and whatever.
Used to be the drinking hour used to be 11 or 12 till 3 Sundays, because everyone's got to get out by 3 and then be back again by 6 for snooker.
So I can just visualise my dad and my father-in-law standing there singing their songs. My dad used to always sing a lot of Matt Munro,
Perry Como,
and my father-in-law used to, his favourite was White Christmas and A Wonderful World.
I said, could I sing a song? And they said, yes, good idea. When I showed the pianist my sheet music, which The Impossible Dream, he said, I'm pleased with that. He said, well, yes, I know that one. So that gave me a lot of confidence. That was very good. So I walked up to the microphone and off he started playing It's Impossible, which is a totally different song to The Impossible Dream. So I'm now standing at the microphone, a 15-year-old, with a hall full of people, and it used to be really busy, in the main hall. And the gentleman on the piano was playing the wrong tune, because he knew it, so he didn't look at it. So I'm now singing to the wrong piece of music. So what did I do? Did I stop? No. I slowly walked over to the piano and slowly put the lid down. And they never asked me to sing again.
No matter who got up on the stage to sing was appreciated. If they were a good singer, bad singer. There was no such thing as a bad singer, because everybody clapped and cheered them on. So I just said, which was lovely. Really, really nice. Why does the sun keep on shining? Why does the sea rush to shore? Don't they know it's the end of the world and you don't love me anymore?
In the small hall, there's a little stage in there, and I was probably about 8 or 9. And I got up on that stage and sung at the Christmas festival. Yeah, it was really weird. For some reason, I was just that confident when he said on the mic, does anyone want to sing? A few adults got up and sung, and then I went up to him and I said, I want to sing. And then I sung Jingle Bells. So everyone else was singing good songs to get up and dance to, and I just stood there and sung Jingle Bells. So, but yeah, it's nice.
Light and bitter, I think it was, I used to drink. My father used to drink Mann's Brown, and they used to come in big bottles like that. And Christmas time, you could get crates of them to store in the scullery for when you have a party.
Yeah.
Well, Christmas, there used to be a big queue here to go up into the big hall. Like, you know, you had to book to get a ticket to go up there.
Easter, you know, Christmas, holidays, school holidays, they would be doing everything for kids. So, and I mean, so much so that the big hall, I don't know if you've been in the big hall, have you? We used to have the pantomimes in the big hall, but one Christmas it was so busy that we had to use the small hall to have the overflow of people going in there because it was just too many people. On one of the pantos, there was a really scary character, and it was a rat. And I never forget, my youngest cousin was petrified, and every time this rat came out on stage, he would actually be in my aunt's, you know, coat screaming. And I remember looking at him thinking, it's not real. But obviously I'm a few years older than him. And I suppose that stands out because he, you know, he wanted to run out. Every time it came on the stage, he wanted to run out.
My friends and I would be sat right up the front, best seats, because we'd got there really early. I would have been probably the first one there. So I got the pick of the seats right at the front. And I remember... I'm not sure what pantomime it was, but there definitely was a Wicked Witch. It scared me a little bit at first. It's hard to distinguish because it was so long ago that they sort of all merged into one. But I was really excited by that. The kids were all given a little juice box and some popcorn or jelly, and we would like sit and be really excited. I actually don't know what our parents would have been doing. Maybe they may have been watching, but they might have decided to just have a drink near the bar. I'm not quite sure what they were up to, but I just remember enjoying the evening with my friends, and that would be a huge highlight of the year as well. I think we had a pantomime, and then it sort of went into like a kids' disco with S Club 7 and Cher, Believe playing.
We used to bring our boys up every Christmas Eve, every New Year's Eve. As Christmas Eve turned into Christmas Day, you'd get at about an hour and a half going around wishing everybody Happy Christmas, same New Year. But it was just such a lovely atmosphere. Everybody knew everybody, and but you welcomed new people. But it was just a proper community place. Real, everything seemed to evolve around this place, didn't it?
Most of my grandchildren learned to walk here. Yeah, they learned to walk. I've got 10 great grandchildren, and they all learned to come up here, walk. My granddaughter got married, had a wedding here, everything, christenings, holy communions, confirmations. Mm. You know, our family came right up through here, you know.
The wedding, yeah.
Right.
Go on.
We went.
No, we met.
We met, right.
Go on.
Yes. I looked after my parents till near enough at their ending, looking after them. And one Saturday night, I deserved a bit of a break. So I had a trip over to Camden Town, and I spotted a quiet little public house on the corner where the buses come through. And I popped in, and this gentleman was in there. Stupid. At the bar.
Where is he?
That's how we met.
I'll be called that.
That's how we met. And we were together for 20 years, and we did the new thing of civil partnerships in 2006, so that makes it 20 plus.
Yeah. Mm.
14 years.
They had a reception.
They had a reception up there.
Yeah.
I was sitting down here. We were sitting, all of us, down here. And Fred says, we've got a wedding upstairs. Mm-hmm. I said, we've got a wedding. And he says, yeah, we've got Ron and Ray. He's got the wedding reception. And it was quite new then, you know. I thought, what?
Because we didn't know then.
We didn't know, really. We didn't know you at the time, you know, as we know each other now.
You kept it one side, didn't you?
We were one side and you were over the other side where we used to just wait at you, you know.
I sort of sit and think even more now, like I'm sitting here thinking about it now, my life wouldn't have been the life I've had without this place, because my mum and dad started coming up here. They met they made friends with these two people that ended up being my mother and father-in-law. So I wouldn't have met my husband if I hadn't have come up here. My kids wouldn't have been born. Loads of things wouldn't have happened. I'd have, like, completely different. So, thank you, Marmy Club.
So what we used to do, we used to bring the women, send them upstairs and ask them what food they wanted, sandwiches or whatever. And we got them settled, and then me and Benny used to go and play snooker for a couple of hours.
I couldn't believe the size of the snooker room. It was just, and the tables, it was just incredible to see a huge room devoted to that game, and all of these tables, they're all kept immaculately. I mean, it was beautiful.
They always had plenty of people playing snooker, and we had professionals used to come up, exhibitions.
Okay.
You know. Now, we used to come down, there were four of us, there was me, my son, and two other fellas, Johnny Bedding and another fella. And we used to give the marker a fiver, £5, and he used to let us play for 2 hours.
Les worked in the snooker hall. They used to call him like a snooker marker. So he cleaned all the tables, maintained them. He had a book, he took the money from each table when it would come up, and then at the end of the week or Sunday morning he'd pay all the money in. If the new members come in, he'd welcome them. He showed some of them how to play snooker, put tips and cues for them.
He used to be full of cues all around the halls, all in them cases. My sister bought it for my 21st birthday, and I'm 73, so that's 52 years ago. I'm 75, I am, yeah, 75.
But all our family had cues. My husband had a cue. When my sons were sort of teenagers, they both had a cue. They didn't used to leave theirs here. They used to bring it back home. We actually found one of them the other day at home in the cupboard with their name on it. So that was nice. It was just my father-in-law had his own cue, my dad. and they just used to leave them there locked up.
When I told my brother-in-law, he's in his 70s, that I've become a member, and he told me a story that when he was a teenager, his dad used to come here, and his dad was a little bit of a ducker and diver, and so Joe's come with his friends. He was a teenager. He's come with his friends for a drink, and they've gone to the toilet. They've come back and they said, "Oh, Joe, your dad's out there playing snooker." So Joe said, "Oh, we'll go and say hello to him." So he went out and said to his dad, spoke to his dad, and his dad's playing snooker, and he said, "Oh, I won this cue, son. I won this in a tournament. Look, it's personalised." And Joe's like, "That's not your name, Dad." And he said, "Oh, never give me your real name, son." But Joe was like, "For the life of me, I can't remember what name was engraved on this, what name he did give them."
It's probably still out there.
Yeah.
The only place we wasn't allowed was the snooker hall. The dads didn't like it, the men down there. You know, so I used to come to the door and shout to my dad, you know, I wanted some more money or something.
Women couldn't go in the snooker hall.
Women couldn't go in the snooker hall, no.
No, you wasn't allowed down there at all. That was a proper men's area. There was a lady up here, and she's quite a forceful lady, and she said to us, "Well, we're not having this anymore." She said, "We're going to go down the snooker hall." She said, "They won't be able to stop us if we're all down there." Ronnie Simpson's.
Elaine or Eileen.
His name was Ronnie Simpson. He was always up here as well, wasn't he? But and so we all went down. I was sort of, I don't know, about 16, I suppose. And we all went down en masse. Loads of women went down there, and the men were like, "Oh, what are you doing? What are you doing?
You can't come down here. You can't
but
come down
they
here."
They still didn't let us down there for a while.
No.
Just looks the same. The clock's still there. I love that clock. But no, it just looks like walls are a different colour. That's the only thing that's different.
Did you know that the clock, the four-face clock, everyone knew it was broken? It's a beautiful... Even, I think there's a picture from 1930-something where this clock is in the middle of it. And once I was in the snooker hall, there was this accident where the ceiling fell down in a place. So there was a party. You know, in the big hall, you have this free-swinging dance floor, which is exactly above the snooker hall. So if they do their swing dance, you think the buffaloes come, you know, in the... And they had a party there on a Saturday night, and while dancing away, you know, and suddenly a big piece of ceiling came falling out and crashed on the table on the right, the number one table. And luckily, no one was playing on the table because it could have
4 points.
Yeah, straight to the pocket. And then it took a while to basically figure out how to restructure it, and the whole ceiling had to be redone. And after that, I played once on my own again, and suddenly I heard this, I was aware of this kind of weird noise, there was some kind of humming going on. And I thought, where does that come from? There's no one in this place. Until I realized that the clock was moving. And I thought, you know, that's weird, because it was broken, it never worked. And I walked around and said, the clock works. All four faces showing different times though. Not time zones or something, New York. It was just completely randomly different times. Because it transpired that the electricians who did the whole rewiring of in this renovation, they also connected. It was just disconnected because it was too loud. And old Ron, who was the house secretary, I said, "Ron, the clock works." I said, "Ah, no." I switched it off again.
Darts is my game. I've never been that keen on pool or snooker, really. I used to practice darts as a 4 or 5 year old, and I was taught darts by a man with one leg, because I guess it was one sport you could really do, really. Old one-legged Ted. Yeah, lost his leg by, he was hanging on the back of a tram, and he fell off the tram, and sliced through his legs there. And yeah, that's why I was a dart player, thanks to good old one-legged Ted. But yeah, snooker's never my thing, really, now.
I was in the Wednesday Mixed League, right? And that's six throwers, right, to each team, and the league's still going now, but you have to have 3 men and 3 women. Also, we've got a Thursday league here as well, which is the East London League.
And there's lovely dirt matches and stuff like that here. And you see all the trophies down there. And all the guys used to have bets in the betting shop next door, William Hill's betting shop. And they'd come in and they'd watch the telly, they'd run a bike out, they put another bet, run a bike in, you know. Because the betting shop, there was no, just a commentary, there's no tellies in the betting shops in those days, you know. And you, if they were, their horses winning, God, dear, oh dear, the noise. You would, it was shocking. But they see, they were ordinary working people. They all loved to gamble. They loved it.
It was a very, very popular place to be. You couldn't get a membership for love or money. You
just couldn't get in here. And they were strict then.
Two members, wasn't it? So you had to know 2 members and they nominated you, and then it went to the committee and they decided whether you was worthy or not.
So you couldn't just join like you probably do now. You have to be interviewed and everything. When I enrolled, you used to, the television room used to be a library. You used to have books all around the walls. It used to be very dark. And I used to go in there. It was like, mind you, I was a bit nervous. It was so dark. It's just me and the president in there. And what do you work at? What do you want to come here for? What's your religion? All them personal questions and everything.
Jimmy, he ruled the roost that if he didn't like you, he wouldn't get into the club. You don't know if he was happy with you or not, you know. So, but I just tried to be myself and told him what I was doing for a living. I honestly don't know. It was a hard man to sort of figure out, you know. I didn't know if I was in or not, you know. But apparently he liked me, so I'm still here 50 years.
I came in on my husband's membership. And as a kid, like, obviously, our dads. My mum was never a member either.
Because she used to be able to bring guests in with her, you know, you're responsible for their behaviour sort of thing.
So the wives were classed as a guest.
As a lady, you weren't a member. Until, I can't record it, maybe 8 years ago. Or 10, I can't record. Probably 8. And then you got full membership.
It was like a secret society. It was very bizarre and nothing went on to encourage people to come here other than, you know, people that were actual members and in the know. There was outsiders weren't encouraged to come in, and you really did have to come in with somebody, you know, who was a member, because you could only join the club, I think it was January to February. It was a very short period of time, and then it was only 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock on a Friday night.
It was almost Soviet-esque the way they tried to, you know, you wanted to join and made it so difficult for people. They just didn't really want people that weren't like them, really, you know. A lot of them, they really didn't. I'm not saying the nice thing, it was class snobbery. I don't know. I rarely heard them talk about it, but yes, they didn't want anybody who knew joining, really. They really didn't. When I first started here, one black lady would come in for the bingo on a Friday night, and she still does now, 12 years on, she's been there. But apart from that, there was no other people of colour whatsoever. But yeah, it was quite right wing, really, a bit UKIP-ish, I suppose. Well, I know the ex-vice president despised Cameron because he thought he was too liberal, he thought he was too left wing, David Cameron, so make it out what you will.
But I don't remember it being very friendly. It felt quite chilly. I mean, I was a foreigner, you know.
When I came here, it was about 3,500 members. At that time, you could drink and drive. And that was another part of it. Then they couldn't park outside, all the parking facilities had stopped with the councils. It shrank drastically. Then after that, there was a kind of a gap with memberships, because a lot of their children left London to go outside London to bring their children up outside London. That was a better and safer place for them. We hadn't got the clientele as such coming in.
Yeah.
got a bit boring coming up here because you'd sit in the big hall, like book a show or something that was on, and there was no atmosphere because there wasn't enough people. So people just stopped coming. And we were all sort of quite sad about that because we knew what it could be like from what we'd had when we were younger.
Most of the club were much older people in their 60s, 70s, and a lot had moved out of the area to Southend and Essex and places, and, you know, Cockfosters, up that sort of direction. And really, they only came to the club on a Saturday night. They didn't come any other time. The club was incredibly quiet, next to nobody in here, very cold. It was...
When I first started on a Wednesday, there were some Wednesdays, not one single person came in. I just sat on my own, I'd read my book, muck around my phone, maybe practice a bit of darts, and not one person would come in. That happened on three or four occasions, but on dozens upon dozens of occasions, I would get no more than five people in the entire evening.
It was bad times and good times. Yeah, there was some good steward and stewardesses and some not so good. The committee had to get rid of some of them. But then when they left, there was a stocktake, and the stocktaker thought there was 422 gallons of beer down there, but had filled them with water.
But as I say, there was so much things going on in this club that money disappeared, and, you know, and there was two people had to deal with the fruit machines, taking out the money and counting and everything. But apparently sometimes it didn't tally up, you know. But this went on all the time. When some work needed to be done here in the club, the same family got the work, and that was the president's son, got all the work here. And some of the work wasn't great.
At the time, the people were on the take, and it wasn't until they left, some of them, they realised, you know, what was happening.
They had raffles and stuff there. So, and they had also, what you call, open the box. You bought a ticket, and your number was on the ticket. And there was 13 keys, but only one of those keys opened the box with the money. And all the keys were in this bag. So you put your hand into the bag and picked out a key, you know, and no, the key wouldn't open the box. So it all built up, and sometimes back then, £700,000. But for weeks and weeks, nobody would ever be able to pick this key. But for some reason, it always seemed to be the same group of people who picked the right key to open the box. Well, having luck like that, yeah, it's got to be good. It's got to be really good to have a luck like that. So, as I say, that was a bit disappointing, really, that there wasn't a closer watch kept on what was going on, you know.
It was in the 90s, anyway. Probably about 95, 97, maybe. There was sometimes we'd have private functions upstairs. The money wasn't there to buy spirits in. So Seamus across the road at the time, he had the off licence. He used to give us the spirits, and we'd pay him the next day for them. And he was very good. On another occasion, we had no gas to bring the beer up. So my partner went to Edmonton in the car and got cylinders of gas for us. They had borrowed money from breweries as well, which had to be paid back. And they were finding it hard to find the money to do that as well. They had Whitbreads and Courages here. They paid off Courages and they owed 20,000 to Whitbreads. So I was here. They said they were going to close the club. And I was here working, and the doorbell went, and there was two men outside with the badges on. They said they were going to put a chain on the door. So I pretended to cry and I said, I'm only a cleaner, I only started here 3 days ago, I don't know who you are, what you are. I'm on my own in the building. I said, I can't let you in, I don't know you. They said, well, we'll be back at 6:30.
I was sitting in work in Hackney, I worked in the accounts there, and got a call from my partner, and the bailiffs were knocking at the door. Two of the women from the club come and sat on the stairs to stop them. I had to jump in a cab and get down as quick as I could. And I found the CIU from the taxi and told them what was happening. They said, they can't do it. Tell them this, tell them that.
But then we got on to the solicitor, Mr. Lord. He was from Manchester, that was dealing with Whitbreads. And I brought the president in at the time to try and deal with it. So he went up and he was rough and ready on the phone with him and said, you can't do this and you can't do that. So I went home and I phoned the solicitor. I said, I apologise of the behaviour of the person you spoke to. I said, can you give us 3 weeks? We'll get the money together. He said, no, I can't give you 3 weeks. He said, I'll give you a week. I said, no, we need 3 weeks and I promise you, you'll get your money. I had been left some money from in a will from an aunt in Florida. So I had 9,000 and Les had the thousands. So we paid the first 10,000 straight up front. I said, you'll have that in 3 days. We need a bit of time to get the rest of the money. He said, I hate dealing with a woman. I said, I promise you, you know, you'll definitely get your money. So the secretary come back and he put 5,000 in. And then another committee person put some money in. So then we paid that off, and then there was still a kind of nothing, if you know what I mean. So we had to kind of beg and borrow while we tried to get back on our feet again, the committee and the club. It was hard work at the time, but we got there.
But we would have lost this club only for May, and Fred Ritchie and his wife. May put thousands of pounds into the club, and so did the Riches, because the bank was closing in on us, and we nearly lost the club. And you got May has to be thanked big time.
One time we thought we were going to sell it.
But I think they were trying to close the club down, or sell part of it off. There's a few committee people involved in that. I didn't know at the time, but some people was bringing people in, showing them the club. The tower people was one of them. They lost their premises. They wanted to take over, I think, the small hall, part of here, part of the snooker hall. I believe it was 2.5 million, which was nothing for the size of this club. Some of the people on the committee at the moment were involved to keep it open. And some of the people have gone off the committee. Some of the people's gone off to committee. They left and they didn't get their own way. So, yeah. And they were trying to keep the memberships down. So, if the place was sold, or partly sold, the members would get a payout. And the members thought it was great. Some of them thought it was great.
Once you're a member, after 5 years membership, you actually have part ownership of the club. You know, it would have been quite a lot of money to them if the club had got sold, but it actually wasn't anything like what the club was worth.
Yeah, there were three people here who are still in the committee or around the committee. There was Andrew Dumbleton and Lawrence Fryer, who is now vice president, and Tom Jones is president now. And these three basically, from inside of the club, you know, prevented that swift move towards sale. And Andrew in particular tried to get as many people as possible to be aware of that joining night. People from the local schools, the parents who know each other and all this stuff. 60 of them, or 70 even, you know, filled out an application form. And you know yourself, you have to have a proposer and a seconder. And the only people who signed for it was Lawrence Fryer and Andrew Dumbleton. They signed every single form.
There weren't that many new members altogether, but those that were the newer members, are younger as well, mainly, had heard about the club going to be sold and forced the committee to have an extraordinary AGM, because to do something like sell a club, you have to have a majority of members, and it's quite a big majority to be able to sell it.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of the year. Now, I started in 2010. I'm guessing this would have been about 2013, 14, I suppose. I hadn't been here long when we had to vote on whether to close or not. And that was, yeah, well, that was, yeah, the run-up to that was, a little bit of a tense atmosphere. I mean, because... Great thing with the club rules, you needed 65% to vote for it.
On the special general meeting, there were, however, 75 votes for the sale. And 100 something against. And when the president, Fred Riches, read out the result, you could see him turning pale. He was shocked. So that was an indication for many that he wanted, I mean, of course, and someone wanted it. But it's, you know...
Lots of us didn't vote for it.
No, no.
You know, because we thought we'd lose club, the club altogether, right. And yeah. It was our club, you know. Grand doesn't last long, does it? Your club lasts forever.
Yeah.
There's not one person left... I'm sure there's not one person left who wanted the club to close is still coming in. Those ones who voted for it to close, they've all gone now, really.
So enough people went to the extraordinary AGM and booted out the idea that the club would be sold. It sort of started a movement going in the club that something had to be done. The people that wanted to save the club sort of became very enthusiastic, and eventually some new members got onto the committee, and gradually... the committee started having a bit of contention in it, really, against some of the policies that were going on, and people tried to get money coming into the club, and a way of doing that was to get a new entertainment manager, so that they started to get the proper value and worth of the club from TV bookings and everything. And gradually some different bands were hired to go into the main hall, while the older crowd still had their kind of music in the smaller hall. And that's how it sort of evolved, started evolving into the club it is today, which hopefully serves everyone, really.
But yeah, then from there on, then it started to come back. And then... the president at the moment, they were building flats out the back near the club's garden, and we had a right of way in. So they sold the right of way, and they got quite a lot of money for that as well. I think it was between 300,000 and 400,000. That was due to his good job and his work. And then that started building back up and bambing. Yeah, but step by step, it seems to be surviving and going ahead at the moment.
Yes, yes. God, such a different place now. But yeah, it's very open. It's very open now for people, whoever, really. It doesn't really matter, which is a fantastic thing. It's not the closed shop it was, you know. Yeah. It's open to anybody who wants to be a member, really. As long as you behave yourself, you're welcome, which I think is fantastic. It makes such an improvement from 12 years ago. It really is. Yes, I mean, the committees are just... in many ways, they're just better human beings, I'm afraid, than the older committee. In many ways, just... you want to do things for the community, you want to help out. Hence, helping out the food bank. Hence the food bank, hence the tenants' association, the residents' association, what have you.
A club has to move on with the times. You know? And it wasn't moving on all the times. But now it's they're doing so much now, it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. For a while, there was no young people coming in here. They just, I don't know what happened. They seemed to stay clear of the club. But now you've got young people coming back. Oh, marvellous. You need the young.
I think we're heading towards 1,500 members, and so the club is a lot busier. But it's really lovely to see that... people are joining and then bringing their children here, because the snooker is getting extremely popular amongst the younger members. By younger members, I mean members and their children who are coming. Yeah. And John Woods does an absolutely epic job at organising all the snooker tournaments and organising the youngsters that are playing snooker. So we see this as our next generation of members. And that, again, is really, really important, that we do encourage a new generation.
Because that's something I told you about, more the children, you know.
That's mums, recently, yeah.
That's it, mums and dads was down there.
Yeah.
And they was making tea and things. But some of them children, because they put balls.
Really?
Girls and all. That's what I like to see, girls getting it. It's a good game.
I found a website. Someone had set up a Mild May website. I was like, wow, they're looking for members. Trudy, I couldn't believe my eyes. I was just like, where's this come from out of the blue? And then we applied and we came down and we was interviewed by, was it Stefan?
Stefan
met us. And wanted to know what our intentions were. What's your intention? We were like, well, to tell you the truth, we can't believe we're actually sitting here. But our intention is to be really well behaved. And we'll be model. We'll put glasses on the bar. Yeah. We'll pick things up off the floor. We just feel so privileged to be here. And I remember we had a little half a lager, didn't we? It was like when we come in at the bar, and that's what, like, my mum would have.
Half lager and lager,
That's a tradition. I mean, it's just memories, such good memories, and the whole idea of it, like...
And I think it's because my mum, Ron and Sheila, they've passed away now. Your dad's passed away, your mum's not well. So it's that way of sort of connecting back to our history.
Keeping it alive, isn't it?
Because most of the pubs that we used to go, that our parents used to go drinking in, they've been closed and turned into houses or shops or whatever. So the only real place that we can go that's got their DNA in it in some way
and
is this place.
Memories, that's true.
So I joined the Mild May as a member, I think, in March of this year, 2022. When I first came, it reminded me of places that I knew from when I was younger, growing up in the north. So there was something quite familiar about it and comfortable in coming here. I get quite tired of a lot of ways that bars, places to spend time in London are heading in terms of just kind of like overly commercial, kind of overly glitzy or too dumbed down in some ways. You know. Whereas this, the Mild May was somewhere to come that had a history and a legacy behind it. Didn't think too much of itself. Knew what it did well. And also pulled a damn good pint of Guinness for £3.50 at the time. So not... It's somewhere, I think me and my good mate Mickey talk about here, is that it's somewhere we can turn up without knowing who's going to be there, take darts, have a couple of drinks and just see who turns up, and you know you'll have a nice evening. I don't think I've had that before with a place to go. You'll have to send a million texts around to organise it, just turn up. See what Unite brings.
Oh.